They say nothing lasts forever, but they're just scared it will last longer than they can love it. Are you there? Are you still walking? They say nothing lasts forever, and I'm writing you in the voice of an endangered species. The truth is, I'm worried they will get us before they get us. Tell me where it hurts. You have my word. Back in Hartford, I used to wander the streets at night by myself. Sleepless, I'd get dressed, climb through the window, and just walk. Some nights I would hear an animal shuffling, unseen, behind garbage bags, or the wind unexpectedly strong overhead, a rush of leaves clicking down, the scrape of branches from a maple out of sight. But mostly, there were only my footsteps on the pavement, steaming with fresh rain, the scent of decade-old tar, or the dirt on a baseball field under a few stars, the gentle brush of grass on the soles of my Vans on a highway median. But one night, I heard something else. Through the lightless window of a street-level apartment, a man's voice in Arabic. I recognized the word Allah. I knew it was a prayer by the tone he used to lift it, as if the tongue was the smallest arm from which a word like that could be offered. I imagined it floating above his head as I sat there on the curb, waiting for the soft clink I knew was coming. I wanted the word to fall like a screw in a guillotine, but it didn't. His voice, it went higher and higher, and my hands, they grew pinker with each inflection. I watched my skin intensify until at last I looked up and it was dawn. It was over. I was blazed in the blood of light. Salat al-Fahir, a prayer before sunrise. Whoever prays the dawn prayer in congregation, said the Prophet Muhammad, it is as if he had prayed the whole night long. I want to believe, walking those aimless nights, that I was praying. For what, I'm still not sure. But I always felt it was just ahead of me. That if I walked far enough, long enough, I would find it, perhaps even hold it up, like a tongue at the end of its word. First developed as a painkiller for cancer patients undergoing chemotherapy, Oxycontin, along with its generic forms, was soon prescribed for all bodily pain, arthritis, muscle spasms, and migraines. Trevor was into Shawshank Redemption and Jolly Ranchers, Call of Duty, and his one-eyed border collie, Mandy. Trevor, who, after an asthma attack, said, hunched over and gasping, I think I just deep-throated an invisible cock. And we both cracked up like it wasn't December and we weren't under an overpass, waiting out the rain on the way home from the needle exchange. Trevor was a boy who had a name, who wanted to go to community college to study physical therapy. Trevor was alone in his room when he died, surrounded by posters of Led Zeppelin. Trevor was 22. Trevor was. The official cause of death, I would learn later, was an overdose from heroin laced with fentanyl. Once, at a writing conference, a white man asked me if destruction was necessary for art. His question was genuine. He leaned forward, his blue gaze twitching under his cap, stitched gold with Nam Vet for life, the oxygen tank connected to his nose hissing beside him. I regarded him the way I do every white veteran from that war, thinking he could be my grandfather. And I said no. No, sir. Destruction is not necessary for art. I said that, not because I was certain, but because I thought my saying it would help me believe it. But why can't the language for creativity be the language of regeneration? You killed that poem, we say. You're a killer. You came in to that novel, guns blazing. I am hammering this paragraph. I am banging them out, we say. I owned that workshop. I shut it down. I crushed them. We smashed the competition. I'm wrestling with the muse. The state where people live is a battleground state. The audience, a target audience. Good for you, man, a man once said to me at a party. You're making a killing with poetry. You're knocking them dead. One afternoon, while watching TV with Lon, we saw a herd of buffalo run, single file, off a cliff. A whole steaming row of them thundering off the mountain in technicolor. Why'd they dye themselves like that? She asked, mouth open. Like usual, I made something up on the spot. They don't mean to, Grandma. They're just following their family. That's all. They don't know it's a cliff. Maybe they should have a stop sign then. We had many stop signs on our block. They weren't always there. There was this woman named Marcia down the street. She was overweight and had hair like a rancher's widow, a kind of mullet cut with thick bangs. She would go door to door, hobbling on her bad leg, gathering signatures for a petition to put up stop signs in the neighborhood. She has two boys herself, she told you at the door, and she wants all the kids to be safe when they play. Her sons were Kevin and Kyle. Kevin, 2 years older than me, overdosed on heroin. 5 years later, Kyle, the younger one, also overdosed. After that, Marcia moved to a mobile park in Coventry with her sister. The stop signs remain. The truth is, we don't have to die if we don't feel like it. Just kidding. Do you remember the morning, after a night of snow, when we found the letters "Fag for Life" scrawled in red spray paint across our front door? The icicles caught the light, and everything looked nice and about to break. What does it mean? You asked, coatless and shivering. It says Merry Christmas, Ma, I said, pointing. See? That's why it's red. For luck. They say addiction might be linked to bipolar disorder. It's the chemicals in our brains, they say. I got the wrong chemicals, Ma. Or rather, I don't get enough of one or the other. They have a pill for it. They have an industry. They make millions. Did you know people get rich off of sadness? I want to meet the millionaire of American sadness. I want to look him in the eye, shake his hand, and say, it's been an honor to serve my country. The thing is, I don't want my sadness to be othered from me, just as I don't want my happiness to be othered. They're both mine. I made them, damn it. What if the elation I feel is not another bipolar episode, but something I fought hard for? Maybe I jump up and down and kiss you too hard on the neck when I learn upon coming home that it's pizza night, because sometimes pizza night is more than enough. It's my most faithful and feeble beacon. What if I'm running outside because the moon tonight is children's book huge and ridiculous over the line of pines, the sight of it a strange sphere of medicine? It's like when all you've been seeing before you is a cliff, and then this bright bridge appears out of nowhere, and you run fast across it, knowing sooner or later there'll be yet another cliff on the other side. What if my sadness is actually my most brutal teacher? And the lesson is always this. You don't have to be like the buffaloes. You can stop. There was a war, the man on TV said. But it's lowered now. Yay, I think, swallowing my pills. The truth is, my recklessness is body width. Once, the ankle bone of a blonde boy underwater. There was a greenish light in that line, and you saw it. The truth is, we can survive our lives, but not our skin. but you know this already. I never did heroin because I'm chicken about needles. When I declined his offer to shoot it, Trevor, tightening the cell phone charger around his arm with his teeth, nodded toward my feet. Looks like you dropped your tampon. Then he winked, smiled, and faded back into the dream he made of himself. Using a multi-million-dollar ad campaign, Purdue sold OxyContin to doctors as a safe, abuse-resistant means of managing pain. The company went on to claim that less than 1% of users became addicted, which was a lie. By 2002, prescriptions of OxyContin for non-cancer pain increased nearly 10 times, with total sales reaching over $3 billion. What if art was not measured by quantity, but ricochets? What if art was not measured? The one good thing about national anthems is that we're already on our feet and therefore ready to run. The truth is, one nation under drugs, under drones. The first time I saw a man naked, he seemed forever. He was my father, undressing after work. I'm trying to end the memory, but the thing about forever is you can't take it back. Let me stay here until the end, I said to the Lord, and we'll call it even. Let me tie my shadow to your feet and call it friendship, I said to myself. I woke to the sound of wings in the room, as if a pigeon had flown through the opened window and was now thrashing against the ceiling. I switched on the lamp. As my eyes adjusted, I saw Trevor sprawled on the floor, his sneaker kicking against the dresser as he rippled under the seizure. We were in his basement. We were in a war. I held his head, foam from his lips spreading down my arm, and screamed for his old man. That night, in the hospital, he lived. It was already the second time. Horror story. Hearing Trevor's voice when I closed my eyes one night 4 years after he died. He's singing this little light of mine again. The way he used to sing it. Abrupt, between lulls in our conversations. His arm hanging out the window of the Chevy, tapping the beat on the faded red exterior. I lay there in the dark, mouthing the words till he appears again, young and warm and enough. The black wren this morning on my windowsill, a charred pear. That meant nothing, but you have it now. Take a right, Ma. There's a lot behind the bait and tackle shack, where one summer I watched Trevor skin a raccoon he shot with Buford Smith & Wesson. He grimaced as he worked the thing out of itself. His teeth green from the drugs, like glow-in-the-dark stars in daylight. On the truck bed, the black pelt rippled in the breeze. A few feet away, a pair of eyes, grained with dirt, stunned by the vision of their new gods. Can you hear it? The wind driving the river behind the Episcopal Church on Willis Street. The closest I've ever come to God was the calm that filled me after orgasm. That night, as Trevor slept beside me, I kept seeing the raccoon's pupils, how they couldn't shut without the skull. I like to think, even without ourselves, that we could still see. I like to think we'd never close. You and I, we were Americans until we opened our eyes. Are you cold? Don't you think it's strange that to warm yourself is to basically touch the body with the temperature of its marrow? They will want you to succeed, but never more than them. They will write their names on your leash and call you necessary, call you urgent. From the wind, I learned a syntax for forwardness, how to move through obstacles by wrapping myself around them. You can make it home this way. Believe me, you can shake the wheat and still be nameless as coke dust on the tender side of a farm boy's fist. How come each time my hands hurt me, they become more mine? Go past the cemetery on House Street, the one with headstones so worn the names resemble bite marks. The oldest grave holds a Marianne Cowder, 1784 to 1784. After all, we are here only once. 3 weeks after Trevor died, a trio of tulips in an earthenware pot stopped me in the middle of my mind. I had woken abruptly and, still dazed from sleep, mistook the dawn light hitting the petals for the flowers emitting their own luminescence. I crawled to the glowing cups, thinking I was seeing a miracle, my own burning bush. But when I got closer, my head blocked the rays and the tulips turned off. This also means nothing, I know. But some nothings change everything after them. In Vietnamese, the word for missing someone and remembering them is the same. Nhớ. Sometimes, when you ask me over the phone, "Con nhớ mẹ không?" I flinch, thinking you meant, "Do you remember me?" I miss you more than I remember you. They will tell you that to be political is to be merely angry, and therefore artless, depthless, raw, and empty. They will speak of the political with embarrassment, as if speaking of Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. They will tell you that great writing breaks free from the political, thereby transcending the barriers of difference, uniting people toward universal truths. They'll say this is achieved through craft above all. "Let's see how it's made," they'll say. As if how something is assembled is alien to the impulse that created it. As if the first chair was hammered into existence without considering the human form. I know. It's not fair that the word laughter is trapped inside slaughter. We'll have to cut it open, you and I, like a newborn lifted, red and trembling from the just-shot dough. Cocaine, laced with oxycodone, makes everything fast and still at once. Like when you're on the train and, gazing across the fog New England fields, at the brick Colt factory where Cousin Victor works, you see its blackened smokestack, parallel to the train, like it's following you, like where you're from won't let you off the hook. Too much joy, I swear, is lost in our desperation to keep it. After riding our bikes for 2 hours one night so Trevor could score on the outskirts of Windsor, we sat on the swings across from the hippopotamus slide in the elementary school playscape, the rubber cold beneath us. He had just shot up. I watched as he held a flame under the plastic transdermal adhesive until the fentanyl bubbled and gathered into a sticky tar at the center. When the plastic warped at the edges, browning, he stopped, took the needle, and sucked the clear liquid past the black ticks on the cylinder. His sneakers grazed the wood chips. In the dark, the purple hippo, its mouth open where you can crawl through, looked like a wrecked car. "Hey, little dog." From his slur, I could tell that his eyes were closed. "Yeah? Is it true, though?" His swing kept creaking. "You think you'll be really gay? Like, forever? I mean," the swing stopped. "I think me, I'll be good in a few years, you know?" I couldn't tell if by really, he meant very gay or truly gay. "I think so," I said, not knowing what I meant. "That's crazy." He laughed. The fake one you use to test the thickness of a silence. His shoulders wilted, the drug running through him steady. Then something brushed my mouth. Startled, I clenched around it anyway. Trevor had slipped a bogey between my lips, lit it. The flame flashed in his eyes, glazed and bloodshot. I swallowed the sweet, scalding smoke, fighting back tears and winning. I considered the stars, the smattering of blue-white phosphorescence, and wondered how anyone could call the night dark. Round the corner by the traffic light, blinking yellow. Because that's what the lights do in our town after midnight. They forget why they're here. You ask me what it's like to be a writer, and I'm giving you a mess, I know. But it's a mess, Ma. I'm not making this up. I made it down. That's what writing is. After all the nonsense, getting down so low, the world offers a merciful new angle. A larger vision made of small things. The lint suddenly a huge sheet of fog, exactly the size of your eyeball. And you look through it and see the thick steam in the all-night bathhouse in Flushing, where someone reached out to me once, traced the trapped flute of my collarbone. I never saw that man's face, only the gold-rimmed glasses floating in the fog, and then the feeling, the velvet heat of it everywhere inside me. Is that what art is? To be touched, thinking what we feel is ours, when, in the end, it was someone else, in longing, who finds us? When Houdini failed to free himself from his handcuffs at the London Hippodrome, his wife, Bess, gave him a long, deep kiss. In doing so, she passed him the key that would save him. If there's a heaven, I think it looks like this. For no reason, I Googled Trevor's name the other day. The white pages says he's still alive, that he's 30 years old and lives only 3.6 miles from me. The truth is memory has not forgotten us. A page turning is a wing lifted with no twin, and therefore no flight. And yet we are moved. While cleaning my closet one afternoon, I found a Jolly Rancher in the pocket of an old Carhartt jacket. It was from Trevor's truck. He always kept them in his cup holder. I unwrapped it, held it between my fingers. The memory of our voices is inside it. "Tell me what you know," I whispered. It caught the light from the window like an ancient jewel. I went inside the closet, closed the door, sat down in the tight dark, and placed the candy, smooth and cool, in my mouth. Green apple. "I'm not with you, because I'm at war with everything but you. A person beside a person inside a life. That's called parataxis. That's called the future. We're almost there. I'm not telling you a story so much as a shipwreck. The pieces floating, finally legible. Head around the bend, past the second stop sign with hate spray-painted in white on the bottom. Walk toward the white house, the one with its left side charcoal gray with exhaust blown from the scrapyard across the highway. There's the upstairs window where, one night when I was little, I woke to a blizzard outside. I was 5 or 6 and didn't know things ended. I thought the snow would continue to the sky's brim, then beyond, touching God's fingertips as he dozed in his reading chair, the equations scattered across the floor of his study. That by morning we would all be sealed inside a blue-white stillness and no one would have to leave, ever. After a while, Lon found me. Or rather, her voice appeared beside my ear. "Little dog," she said as I watched the snow. "You want to hear a story? I tell you a story." I nodded. "Okay," she went on. "Long ago, one woman held her daughter like this." She squeezed my shoulders. "On a dirt road. This girl named Rose. Yes. Like flower. Yes, this girl. Her name Rose. That's my baby, okay? I hold her, my daughter, little dog." She shakes me. "You know her name? It's rose, like flower. Yes, this little girl I hold in dirt road. Nice girl, my baby, red hair. Her name is... And we went on like that, till the street below glowed white, erasing everything that had a name. What were we before we were we? We must have been standing by the shoulder of a dirt road while the city burned. We must have been disappearing, like we are now. Maybe in the next life we'll meet each other for the first time, believing in everything but the harm we're capable of. Maybe we'll be the opposite of buffaloes. We'll grow wings and spill over the cliff as a generation of monarchs heading home. Green apple, like snow covering the particulars of the city. They will say we never happened, that our survival was a myth, but they're wrong. You and I, we were real. We laughed knowing joy would tear the stitches from our lips. Remember, the rules, like streets, can only take you to known places. Underneath the grid is a field. It was always there, where to be lost is never to be wrong, but simply more. As a rule, be more. As a rule, I miss you. As a rule, little is always smaller than small. Don't ask me why. I'm sorry I don't call enough. Green apple. I'm sorry I keep saying, how are you, when I really mean, are you happy? If you find yourself trapped inside a dimming world, remember it was always this dark inside the body, where the heart, like any law, stops only for the living. If you find yourself, then congratulations. Your hands are yours to keep. Take a right on Risley. If you forget me, then you've gone too far. Turn back. Good luck. Good night. Good Lord. Green apple. The room is silent as a photograph. Lan is stretched out on the floor on a mattress. Her daughters, you and Mai, and I, are by her side. Wrapped around her head and neck is a sweat-soaked towel, making a hood that frames her skeletal face. Her skin had stopped trying, the eyes fallen into her skull, as if peering from inside the brain itself. She resembles a wood carving, shriveled and striated with deep lines. The only indication that she's alive is her favorite yellow blanket, now gray, rising and falling on her chest. You say her name for the fourth time, and her eyes open, searching each of our faces. On the nearby table, a pot of tea we forget to drink. And it was that floral, sweet jasmine scent that makes me aware, by contrast, of the caustic, acrid odor undercutting the air. Lan has been lying in the same spot for 2 weeks, with the slightest movement shooting pain through her thin frame. She developed bed sores under her thighs and back that got infected. She has lost control over her bowels, and the bedpan beneath her is perpetually half full, her insides literally letting go of themselves. My stomach grabs as I sit, fanning her, her remaining strands of hair fluttering at her temples. She peers at each of us, again and again, as if waiting for us to change. I'm burning, she says, when she finally speaks. I'm burning like a hut inside. Your voice, in reply, is the softest I've ever heard it. We'll put water on it, Ma, okay? We're gonna put out the fire. The day Lan was diagnosed, I stood in the doctor's nothing white office as he spoke, his voice sounding underwater, pointing to various sections of my grandmother, her skeleton pinned against the backlit screen. But what I saw was emptiness. On the X-ray, I stared at the space between her leg and hip, where the cancer had eaten a third of her upper femur and part of the socket, the ball completely gone, the right hip porous and mottled. It reminded me of a sheet of metal, rusted and corroded thin in a junkyard. There was no evidence as to where that part of her disappeared to. I looked closer. Where was the translucent cartilage, the marrow, the minerals, the salt and sinew, the calcium that once formed her bones? I felt then, as the nurses droned on around me, a new and singular anger. My jaw and fists tensed. I wanted to know who did this. I needed this act to have an author, a consciousness held in a defined and culpable space. For once, I wanted, needed an enemy. Stage 4 bone cancer was the official diagnosis. While you waited in the hall with Lon in the wheelchair, the doctor handed me the manila envelope with the x-rays inside and simply said, avoiding my gaze, to take your grandma home and give her whatever she wanted to eat. She had 2 weeks, maybe 3. We brought her home, laid her back on a mat on the tile floor where it was cool, placed pillows along her length to keep her legs in place. What made it worse, you remember, was that Lon had never once believed, even to the end, that she had a terminal illness. We explained her diagnosis to her, about the tumors, the cells, metastasis, nouns so abstract that we might as well have been describing witchcraft. We told her that she was dying, that it would be 2 weeks, then 1 week, any day now. Be ready. Be ready. What do you want? What do you need? What would you like to say? We urged, but she wouldn't have it. She said we were just children, that we didn't know everything yet, and that when we grow up, we'd know how the world really works. And because denial, fabrication, storytelling was her way of staying one step ahead of her life, how could any of us tell her she was wrong? Pain, however, is no story in itself. In these last few days, while you were out making funeral arrangements, picking out the coffin, Lon would howl and cry out in long, piercing bursts. What have I done? She'd say, looking at the ceiling. God, what have I done to have you step on me like this? We would give her the synthetic Vicodin and Oxycontin prescribed by the doctor, then the morphine, then more morphine. I fanned her with a paper plate as she drifted in and out of consciousness. Mai, who had driven all night from Florida, shuffled through the rooms, cooking food and making tea in a zombie-like daze. Because Lon was too weak to chew, Mai would spoon oatmeal into her barely opened mouth. I kept fanning as Mai fed her. The two women, mother's and daughter's black hair fluttering in unison, their foreheads almost touching. A few hours later, you and Mai rolled Lon on her side and, with a rubber-gloved hand, removed the feces from your mother's body, too wasted to expel its own waste. I kept fanning her face, jeweled with sweat, her eyes shut as you worked. When it was over, she just lay there, blinking. I asked her what she was thinking. As if waking from a sleepless dream, she answered in a gutted monotone. I used to be a girl, little dog. You know? Okay, Grandma, I know. But she wasn't listening. I used to put a flower in my hair and walk in the sun. After big rain, I walk in the sun. The flower I put on my ear, so wet. So cool. Her eyes drifted from me. It's a stupid thing, she shook her head. Stupid thing to be a girl. After a while, she turned back to me as if remembering I was there. You eat yet? We try to preserve life, even when we know it has no chance of enduring its body. We feed it, keep it comfortable, bathe it, medicate it, caress it, even sing to it. We tend to these basic functions not because we are brave or selfless, but because, like breath, it is the most fundamental act of our species, to sustain the body until time leaves it behind. I'm thinking now of Duchamp, his infamous sculpture, how by turning a urinal, an object of stable and permanent utility, upside down, he radicalized its reception. By further naming it fountain, he divested the object of its intended identity, rendering it with an unrecognizable new form. I hate him for this. I hate how he proved that the entire existence of a thing could be changed simply by flipping it over, revealing a new angle to its name, an act completed by nothing else but gravity, the very force that traps us on this earth. Mostly, I hate him because he was right. Because that's what was happening to Lan. The cancer had refigured not only her features, but the trajectory of her being. Lan turned over would be dust, the way even the word dying is nothing like the word dead. Before Lan's illness, I found this act of malleability to be beautiful, that an object or person, once upturned, becomes more than its once singular self. This agency for evolution, which once made me proud to be the queer yellow faggot that I was and am, now betrays me. Sitting with Lan, my mind slides unexpectedly to Trevor. Trevor, who by then had been dead just 7 months. I think of the first time we had sex, not with his cock in my palm like we usually did, but for real. It was the September after my second season on the farm. The crop was all hung, packed from beam to the rafters, their leaves already wrinkled, the green, once deep and lush in the fields, now dulled to the shade of old uniforms. It was time to fire the coals and speed the curing process. This required that someone stay all night in the barn, burning briquettes piled in tin pie plates set 8 or 10 feet apart across the dirt floor. Trevor had asked me to come hang out for the night while he stoked the coals. All around us, the heaps burned, glowing red and flickering each time a draft made its pass through the slats. The sweet scent swelled as the heat warped its way toward the roof. It was past midnight by the time we found ourselves on the barn's floor, the oil lamp's gold halo holding off the dark around us. Trevor leaned in. I parted my lips in anticipation, but he left them untouched, going lower this time, until his teeth grazed the skin below my neck. This was before I knew how far into the year those incisors would sink, before I knew the heat in that boy's marrow, his knuckled American rage, his father's inclination for weeping on the front porch after 3 coronas while the Patriots crackled on the radio and a hardback of Dean Koontz's Fear Nothing sat by his side, before the old man found Trevor passed out in the Chevy's truck bed in a thunderstorm, the water lapping at his boy's ears as he dragged him through the mud, the ambulance, the hospital room, the heroin hot in Trevor's veins, before he would come out of the hospital clean for a whole 3 months before hitting it again. The air, close and thick from the summer's last heat, whistled low through the barn. I pressed myself into his sun-baked skin, still warm from the day in the field, his teeth ivory and unrotted, nibbled my chest, nipples, stomach, and I let him, because nothing could be taken from me, I thought, if I had already given it away. Our clothes fell off us like bandages. Let's just do it. On top of me, his voice strained as he struggled to kick off his boxers. I nodded. I'll be slow, okay? His mouth a gash of youth. I'll be easy. I turned, tentative, thrilled, toward the dirt floor, planted my forehead on my arm, and waited. My shorts at my ankles, Trevor postured up behind me. His pubes brushing against me, he spat several times into his hand, rubbed the spit between my legs until everything was thick and slick and undeniable. I put my head back down. The scent of dirt from the barn floor, notes of spilled beer and iron-rich soil as I listened to the wet clicks of his cock as he stroked his spit along its length. When he pushed, I felt myself scream, but didn't. Instead, my mouth was full of salted skin, then the bone underneath as I bit down on my arm. Trevor stopped, not yet all the way in, sat up and asked if I was okay. I don't know, I said into the floor, panting. Don't cry on me again. Don't you cry on me now. He spat another wad, let it fall on his length. Let's try again. If it's bad, we'll stop for good. Okay. He pushed, deeper this time, pushed his weight down hard and slid inside me. The pain sparked white in the back of my head. I bit down, my wrist bone touched the contours of my teeth. I'm in, little man. His voice cracked into the whisper-shout terror of a boy who got exactly what he wanted. I'm in, he said, astonished. I can feel it. Fuck, oh fuck. I told him to hold still as I braced against the dirt floor and gathered myself. The pain shot out from between my legs. Let's keep going, he said. I gotta keep going. I don't want to stop. Before I could respond, he was pumping again. His arms planted on each side of my head, the heat pulsing from them as he worked. He was wearing his gold cross, the one he never takes off, and it kept poking at my cheek. So I took it in my mouth to keep it steady. It tasted like rust, salt, and Trevor. The sparks in my head bloomed with each thrust. After a while, the pain melted into a strange ache, a weightless numbness that swept through me like a new, even warmer season. The feeling brought on, not by tenderness, as from caress, but by the body having no choice but to accommodate pain by dulling it into an impossible, radiating pleasure. Getting fucked in the ass felt good, I learned, when you outlast your own hurt. What Simone Veil said, perfect joy excludes even the very feeling of joy. For in the soul filled by the object, no corner is left for saying, I. As he heaved above me, I unconsciously reached back to touch myself, to make sure I was still there, still me. But my hand found Trevor instead, as if by being inside me, he was this new extension of myself. The Greeks thought sex was the attempt of two bodies separated long ago to return to one life. I don't know if I believed this, but that's what it felt like, as if we were two people mining one body, and in doing so merged until no corner was left saying I. Then, about 10 minutes in, as Trevor went faster, our skin sucking with humid sweat, something happened. A scent rose up to my head, strong and deep like soil, but sharp with flaw. I knew right away what it was, and panicked. In the heat of it, I didn't think, didn't yet know how to prepare myself. The porn clips I had seen never showed what it took to arrive where we were. They just did it, quick, immediate, sure, and spotless. No one had shown us how this was to be done. No one had taught us how to be this deep and deeply broken. Ashamed, I pressed my forehead to my wrist and let it throb there. Trevor slowed, then paused. all quiet. Above us, the moths flitted between the tobacco. They had come to feed on the plants, but the pesticides left over from the fields killed them as soon as they placed their mouths on the leaves. They fell all around us. Their wings, in the midst of death throes, buzzed across the barn floor. Fuck. Trevor stood up, his face disbelieving. I turned away. Sorry, I said instinctually. His cock touched at the tip with the dark inside me, pulsed under the lamplight as it softened. I was, in that moment, more naked than I was with my clothes off. I was inside out. We had become what we feared most. He breathed hard above me. Trevor being who he was, raised in the fabric and muscle of American masculinity, I feared for what would come. It was my fault. I had tainted him with my faggotry, the filthiness of our act exposed by my body's failure to contain itself. He stepped toward me. I rose to my knees, half covered my face, bracing. Lick it up. I flinched. Sweat shone on his forehead. A moth, suffocating, thrashed against my right knee, its huge and final death merely a quiver on my skin. A breeze shifted the dark outside. A car hummed down the road across the fields. He gripped my shoulder. How did I already know he would react like this? I twisted my face to meet him. I said, get up. What? I searched his eyes. I had misheard. Come on, he said again. Get the hell up. Trevor pulled me by the arm to my feet. We stepped out of the oil lamp's gold circle, leaving it empty and perfect again. He led me along the barn, his grip tight. The moths dipped in and out between us. When one hit my forehead and I stopped, he yanked and I stumbled behind him. We reached the other side, then through the door, into the night. The air was cool and starless. In the sudden dark, I made out only his pale back, gray-blue in the unlight. After a few yards, I heard the water, the river's current, although gentle, frothed white around his thighs. The crickets grew louder, lush. The trees rustled unseen in the massed shadows across the river. Then Trevor let go, dipped under, before quickly surfacing. Droplets ran down his jaw, tinkled around him. Clean yourself, he said, his tone oddly tender, almost frail. I pinched my nose and dunked under, gasping from the cold. In an hour, I'll be standing in our dim kitchen, the river still damp in my hair, and Lon will shuffle into the glow of the nightlight above the stove. I won't tell anyone you've been at sea, little dog. She will put her finger over her lips and nod. This way, the pirate spirits won't follow you. She will take a dish rag and dry my hair, my neck, pausing over the hickey that, by then, will be the shade of dried blood under my jaw. You've been far away. Now you home. Now you dry, she will say, as the floorboards creak under our shifting weight. The river up to my chest now. I waved my arms to keep steady. Trevor put his hand on my neck and we stood quiet for a moment, our heads bent over the river's black mirror. He said, don't worry about that. You heard? The water moved around me, through my legs. Hey. He did that thing where he made a fist under my chin and tilted my head up to meet his gaze, a gesture that would usually get me to smile. You heard me? I just nodded, then turned to shore. I was only a few steps ahead of him before I felt his palm push hard between my shoulders, leaning me forward, my hands instinctually braced on my knees. Before I could turn around, I felt his stubble, first between my thighs, then higher. He had knelt in the shallows, knees sunk in river mud. I shook, his tongue so impossibly warm compared to the cold water, the sudden wordless act willed as a balm to my failure in the barn. It felt like an appalling second chance, to be wanted again in this way. Far across the fields, just beyond a line of sycamores, a single lit window in the upstairs room of an old farmhouse flickered in the dark. Above it, a handful of straggling stars were biting through the sky's milky haze. He gripped my thighs with both hands, pressed me into him to further prove the point. I stared at the water's convulsed shapes as I caught my breath. I looked between my legs and saw his chin moving to work the act into what it was, what it always has been, a kind of mercy. To be clean again. To be good again. What have we become to each other, if not what we've done to each other? Although this was not the first time he did this, it was the only time the act gained new concussive power. I was devoured, it seemed, not by a person, a Trevor, so much as by desire itself. To be reclaimed by that want. To be baptized by its pure need. That's what I was. When he was finished, he wiped his mouth with the back of his arm, then mussed my hair before wading to shore. "Good as always," he said over his shoulder. "Always," I repeated, as if answering a question, then headed for the barn, where, under the oil lamp's waning glow, the moths kept dying. After breakfast, around 10, while I sit on the front porch reading, Mai grabs my arm. "It's time," she says. I blink. She's going. We rush into the living room where you're already kneeling at Lan's side. She's awake and mumbling, her eyes roving under their half-shut lids. You run to grab bottles of aspirin and Advil from the cupboards, as if ibuprofen would do us any good now. But to you, it is all medicine, remedies that had worked before. Why shouldn't they work now? You sit beside your mother. Your hands, finally empty, lie in your lap. Mai points to Lan's toes. "They're turning purple," she says with eerie calm. "The feet. They go first, and they're purple. Only a half hour now, at most." I watch Lan's life begin to recede from itself. "Purple," Mai had said. But Lan's feet don't look purple to me. They're black, burnished brown at the tips of the toes, stone dark everywhere else, save for the toenails, which had an opaque yellowish tint, like bone itself. But it's the word purple, and with it that lush deep hue that floods me. That's what I see as I watch the blood pull out of Lan's black feet, the green surrounded by clusters of violet in my mind, and realize the word is dragging me into a memory. Years ago, when I was 6 or 7, while walking with Lan along a dirt path that hugged the highway off Church Street, she abruptly stopped and shouted. I couldn't hear her over the traffic. She pointed out the chain-link fence that divided the interstate from the sidewalk, eyes pupil-wide. "Look, little dog." I stooped down, examined the fence. "I don't get it, Grandma. What's wrong?" "No," she said, annoyed. "Get up. Look past the fence. There, those purple flowers." Just beyond the fence, on the highway side, lay a spill of violet wildflowers, each blossom no larger than a thumbnail with a tiny yellow-white center. Lan crouched, held my shoulders, leveling her eyes with mine, serious. "Will you climb it, little dog?" Her gaze narrowed in mock skepticism, waiting. "Of course," I nodded eagerly. And she knew that I would. "I'll boost you up," and you just grab them quick, all right? I latched on to the fence as she lifted my hips. After wavering a bit, I made it to the top, straddled it. I looked down and immediately felt sick. The flowers somehow tiny, faint brush strokes on a whir of green. The wind from the cars blasted my hair. I don't know if I can, I shouted, near tears. Lon grabbed my calf. I'm right here. I won't let anything happen to you, she said over the traffic. If you fall, I cut open the fence with my teeth and save you. I believed her and jumped, landed in a roll, got up, and brushed myself off. Get them by the roots with both hands, she grimaced as she clung to the fence. You have to be quick or we'll get in trouble. I pulled one bush up after the other, the roots bursting from the dirt in ashy clouds. I tossed them over the fence. Each passing car made a gust so strong I almost fell over. I pulled and pulled, and Lon stuffed them all in a plastic 7-Eleven bag. Okay, that's good enough. She waved me back over. I leapt up the fence. Lon reached up and pulled me down into her arms, clutching me. She began to shudder, and not until she put me down did I realize she was giggling. You did it, little dog. You're my flower hunter. The best flower hunter in USA. She held up one of the bushes in the chalky ochre light. These will be perfect on our windowsill. It was beauty, I learned, that we risked ourselves for. That night, when you came home, you pointed at our harvest foaming across the brown, dirt-polluted windowsill, their tendrils lacing along the dining table, and asked, impressed, how we got them. Lon gave a dismissive wave, saying we had found them, thrown out on the curbside by a flower shop. I peered from my toy soldiers at Lon, who placed a finger over her lips and winked as you took off your coat, your back to us. Her eyes smiled. I would never know those flowers by name, because Lon never had one for them. To this day, every time I see small purple flowers, I swear they're the flowers I had picked that day. But without a name, things get lost. The image, however, is clear. Clear and purple, the color that climbs now to Lon's shins as we sit, waiting for it to run through her. You stay close to your mother and brush away the hair matted on her emaciated, skullish face. What do you want, Ma? You ask, your mouth at her ear. What do you need from us? You can have anything. Outside the window, the sky is a mocking blue. Rice, I remember Lon saying, her voice somewhere deep inside her. A spoonful of rice. She swallows, takes another breath. From Gokam. We eye each other, the request impossible. Still, Mai gets up and disappears behind the beaded kitchen curtain. Half an hour later, she kneels beside her mother, a steaming bowl of rice in her hand. She holds the spoon to Lan's toothless mouth. Here, Ma, she says, stoic. It's Gokam rice, just harvested last week. Lon chews, swallows, and something like relief spreads across her lips. So good, she says, after her one and only bite. So sweet. That's our rice. So sweet. She motions at something far away with her chin and dozes off. 2 hours later, she stirs awake. We crowd around her, hear the single deep inhale pull down her lungs, as if she was about to dive underwater. And then, that's it. No exhale. She simply stills, like someone had pressed pause on a movie. I sit there as you and Mai, without hesitation, move about, your arms hovering over your mother's stiff frame. I do the only thing I know, My knees to my chest, I start to count her purple toes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I rock to the numbers as your hands float over the body, methodic as nurses doing rounds. Despite my vocabulary, my books, knowledge, I find myself folded against the far wall, bereft. I watch two daughters care for their own with an inertia equal to gravity. I sit with all my theories, metaphors, and equations, Shakespeare and Milton, Bach, Dufu, and Homer, masters of death who can't, at last, teach me how to touch my dead. After lawn is cleaned and changed, after the sheets removed, the bodily fluids scrubbed from the floor and the corpse, because that's what language dictates now, corpse instead of her, we gather again around lawn. With all your fingers, you pry open her stuck jaw, while on the other side, my slips Lan's dentures inside. But because rigor mortis has already set in, the jaws clamp down before the set of incisors can be secured and the dentures pop out, fall onto the floor with a hard clack. You let out a scream, which you quickly silence with a hand over your mouth. Fuck, you say in rare English. Fuck, fuck, fuck. With the second attempt, the teeth click into place, and you fall back against the wall beside your gone mother. Outside, a dump truck clanks and beeps its way down the block. A few pigeons gargle among the scattered trees. At the bottom of it all, you sit, Mai's head rested on your shoulders, your mother's body cooling a few feet away. Then, your chin turning into a peach pit, you lower your face into your hands. Lan has been dead 5 months now, and for 5 months has sat in an urn on your bedside table. But today, we're in Vietnam, Dinh Giang province, home of Gokong district. It is summer. The rice paddies sweep out around us, endless and green as the sea itself. After the funeral, after the monks in saffron robes chant and sing around her polished granite gravestone, the neighbors from the village with trays of food lifted over their heads, the ones with white hair who recall Lan's life here nearly 30 years ago, offer their anecdotes and condolences. After the sun dips under the rice fields, and all that's left is the grave site, its dirt still fresh and damp